things. Uwe stares back. "Another second, I mean," clarifies the man who still has a banana in his hand.
"It could have gone quite badly, that,"
sniggers the first hard hat.
"Really badly,"
the other one agrees.
"Could have died, actually,"
clarifies the third.
"You're a real hero. Saved their life. His."
"Saved his life," Uwe corrects, and hears Sonia's voice in his own.
"Would have died, otherwise," the third one reiterates, taking a forthright bite of his banana.
On the track is the train with all its red emergency lights turned on, puffing and screeching like a very fat person who's just run into a wall. A great number of examples of what Uwe assumes must be IT consultants and other disreputable folk come streaming out and stand about dizzily on the platform. Uwe puts his hands in his trouser pockets.
"I suppose now you'll have a lot of bloody delayed trains as well," he says, and looks with particular displeasure at the chaotic press of people on the platform.
"Yeah,"
says the first hard hat.
"Reckon so," says the other. "Lots and lots of delays," the third one agrees.
Uwe makes a sound like a heavy bureau that's got a rusted-up hinge. He goes past all three of them without a word.
"Where you off to? You're a hero,"
the first hard hat yells at him, surprised.
"Yeah,"
yells the other.
"A hero,"
yells the third. Uwe doesn't answer. He walks past the man behind the plexiglass, back out into the snow-covered streets, and starts walking home. The town slowly wakes up around him with its foreign-made cars, and its statistics and credit card debt, and all its other crap. "And so this day is also ruined," he confirms with bitterness. As he's walking alongside the bicycle shed by the parking area, he sees the white Skoda coming past from the direction of Anita and Runa's house. A determined woman with glasses is sitting in the passenger seat, her arms filled with files and papers. Behind the wheel sits the man in the white shirt. Uwe has to jump out of the way to avoid being run over as the car races round the corner. The man lifts a smouldering cigarette towards Uwe through the windscreen and offers a superior half-smile. As if it's Uwe's fault that he's in the way, but he's generous enough to let it go.
"Idiot,"
Uwe yells after the Skoda, but the man in the white shirt doesn't seem to react at all. Uwe memorizes the registration number before the car disappears round the corner.
"Soon it'll be your turn, you old fart," hisses a malevolent voice behind him.
Uwe spins round with his fist instinctively raised, and finds himself staring at his own reflection in blonde weed sunglasses. She's holding that damn mutt in her arms. It growls at him. "They were from the social," she jeers with a nod towards the road. In the parking area, Uwe sees that imbecile Anders reversing his Audi out of his garage. It has those new wave-shaped headlights, Uwe notes, presumably designed so that no one at night will be able to avoid the insight that here comes a car driven by an utter shit.
"What business is it of yours?" Uwe says to the weed.
Her lips are pulled into the sort of grimace that comes as close to a real smile as a woman whose lips have been injected with environmental waste and nerve toxins is ever likely to achieve.
"It's my business, because this time it's that bloody old man at the bottom of the road they're putting in a home, and after that it'll be you!"
She spits at the ground beside him and walks towards the Audi. Uwe watches her, his chest puffing in and out under his shirt. As the Audi swings round, she shows him the middle finger on the other side of the window. Uwe's first instinct is to run after them and tear that German sheet metal monster, inclusive of imbeciles, weeds, growling mutts and wave-shaped headlights, to smithereens. But then suddenly he feels out of breath, as if he's been running full tilt through the snow. He leans forward, puts his hands on his knees and notices to his own fury that he's panting for air and his heart racing. He straightens up after a minute or so. There's a slight flickering effect in his right eye. The Audi has gone. Uwe turns round and slowly heads back to his house, one hand pressed to his chest. When he gets to his house, he stops by the shed, stares down into a cat-shaped hole in the snowdrift.
There's a cat at the bottom of it.
Might have bloody known.
Chapter 16. A man who was Uwe and a truck in the forest. Before that day when the dour and slightly fumbling boy with the muscular body and the sad blue eyes sat down beside Sonia on the train, there were really only three things she loved unconditionally in her life. Books, her father, and cats. She'd obviously had quite a lot of attention. It wasn't that. The suitors had come in all shapes and sizes, tall and dark or short and blonde and fun-loving and dull and elegant and boastful and handsome and greedy. And if they hadn't been slightly dissuaded by the stories in the village of Sonia's father keeping one or two firearms in the isolated wooden house out there in the woods, they would most likely have been a bit pushier too. But none of them had looked at her the way that boy looked at her when he sat down beside her on the train, as if she was the only girl in the world. Sometimes, especially in the first few years, some of her girlfriends questioned the choice she had made. Sonia was very beautiful, as the people around her seemed to find it so important to keep telling her. Furthermore, she loved to laugh, and whatever life threw at her, she was the sort of person who took a positive view of it. But Uwe was, well, Uwe was Uwe. Something which the people around her also kept telling Sonia. He'd been a grumpy old man since he started junior school, they insisted, and she could have someone so much better. But to Sonia, Uwe was never dour and awkward and sharp-edged. To her, he was the slightly dishevelled pink flowers at their first dinner. He was his father's slightly too tight-fitting brown suit across his broad, sad shoulders. He believed so strongly in things, justice and fair play and hard work, and a world where right just had to be right. Not so one could get a medal or a diploma or a slap on the back for it, but just because that was how it was supposed to be. Not many men of his kind were made anymore, Sonia had understood. So she was holding on to this one. Maybe he didn't write her poems or serenade her with songs or come home with expensive gifts. But no other boy had gone the wrong way on the train for hours every day just because he liked sitting next to her while she spoke. And when she took hold of his lower arm, thick as her thigh, and tickled him until that sulky boy's face opened up in a smile, it was like a plaster cast cracking round a piece of jewellery. And when this happened, it was as if something started singing inside Sonia. And they only belonged to her, those moments. She didn't get angry with him that first night they had dinner, when he told her he'd lied about his military service. Of course she got angry with him on an immeasurable number of occasions after that, but not that night. They say the best men are born out of their faults, and that they often improve later on, more than if they'd never done anything wrong, she'd said gently. Who said that? Asked Uwe, and looked at the triple set of cutlery in front of him on the table, the way one might look at a box that had just been opened while someone said, "Choose your weapon." Shakespeare, said Sonia. Is that any good? Uwe wondered. It's fantastic, Sonia nodded, smiling. I've never read anything with him, mumbled Uwe into the tablecloth. By him, Sonia corrected, and lovingly put her hand on his. In their almost 4 decades together, Sonia taught hundreds of pupils with learning difficulties to read and write, and she got them to read Shakespeare's collected works. In the same period, she never managed to make Uwe read a single Shakespeare play. But as soon as they moved into their terraced house, he spent every evening for weeks on end in the tool shed. And when he was done, the most beautiful bookcases she had ever seen were in their living room. You have to keep them somewhere, he muttered, and poked a little cut on his thumb with the tip of a screwdriver. And she crept into his arms and said that she loved him. And he nodded. She only asked once about the burns on his arms. And she had to piece together the exact circumstances of how he lost his parental home, from the succinct fragments on offer when Uwe reluctantly revealed what had happened. In the end, she found out how he got the scars, and when one of her girlfriends asked why she loved him, she answered
that most men ran away from an inferno, but men like Uwe ran into it. Uwe did not meet Sonia's father more times than he could count on his fingers. The old man lived a long way north, a good way into the forest, almost as if he had consulted a map of all the population centres in the country before concluding that this was as far from other people as one could live. Sonia's mother died in the maternity bed. Her father never remarried.
"I have a woman, she's just not home at the moment," he spat out, the few times anyone dared bring up the question.
Sonia moved to the local town when she started studying for her upper secondary examinations, all in humanities subjects, at a sixth form college. Her father looked at her with boundless indignation when she suggested that he might like to come with her.
"What can I do there? Meet folk?" he growled.
He always spoke the word folk as if it was a swear word. So Sonia let him be. Apart from her weekend visits and his monthly trip in the truck to the grocery store in the nearest village, he only had Ernest for company. Ernest was the biggest farm cat in the world. When Sonia was small, she actually thought he was a pony. He came and went in her father's house as he pleased, but he didn't live there. Where he lived, in fact, was not known to anyone. Sonia named him Ernest, after Ernest Hemingway. Her father had never bothered with books, but when his daughter sat reading the newspaper at the age of 5, he wasn't so stupid that he tried to avoid doing something about it.
"A girl can't read shit like that. She'll lose her head," he stated, as he pushed her towards the library counter in the village.
The old librarian didn't quite know what he meant by that, but there was no doubt about the girl's quite outstanding intellect. The monthly trip to the grocery store simply had to be extended to a monthly trip to the library, the librarian and father decided together, without any particular need to discuss it further. By the time Sonia passed her 12th birthday, she had read all the books at least twice. The ones she liked, such as The Old Man and the Sea, she'd read so many times that she'd lost count. So Ernest ended up being called Ernest, and no one owned him. He didn't talk, but he liked to go fishing with her father, who appreciated his qualities. They would share the catch equally once they got home. The first time Sonia brought Uwe out to the old wooden house in the forest, Uwe and her father sat in buttoned-up silence opposite each other, staring down at their food for almost an hour, while she tried to encourage some form of civilized conversation. Neither of the two men could quite understand what they were doing there, apart from the fact that it was important to the only woman either of them cared about. They had both protested about the whole arrangement, insistently and vociferously, but without success. Sonia's father was negatively disposed from the very beginning. All he knew about this boy was that he came from town, and that Sonia had mentioned that he did not like cats very much. These were two characteristics, as far as he was concerned, that gave him reason enough to view Uwe as unreliable. As for Uwe, he felt he was at a job interview, and he had never been very good at that sort of thing. So when Sonia wasn't talking, which admittedly she did almost all of the time, there was a sort of silence in the room that can only arise between a man who does not want to lose his daughter and a man who has not yet completely understood that he has been chosen to take her away from there. Finally, Sonia kicked Uwe's shinbone to make him say something. Uwe looked up from his plate and noted the angry twitches around the edges of her eyes. He cleared his throat and looked around with a certain desperation to find something to ask this old man about, because this was what Uwe had learned. If one didn't have anything to say, one had to find something to ask. If there was one thing that made people forget to dislike one, it was when they were given the opportunity to talk about themselves. At long last, Uwe's gaze fell on the truck, visible through the old man's kitchen window.
"That's an L10, isn't it?" he said, pointing with his fork.
"Yep," said the old man, looking down at his plate.
"Saab is making them now,"
Uwe stated with a short nod.
"Scania,"
the old man roared, glaring at Uwe. And the room was once again overwhelmed by that silence which can only arise between a woman's beloved and her father. Uwe looked down grimly at his plate. Sonia kicked her father on his shin. Her father looked back at her grumpily until he saw those twitches around her eyes. He was not so stupid a man that he had not learned to avoid what tended to happen after them. So he cleared his throat irately and picked at his food.
"Just because some suit at Saab waved his wallet around and bought the factory, it don't stop being a Scania," he grunted in a low voice, which was slightly less accusing, and then moved his shinbones a little further from his daughter's shoe.
Sonia's father had always driven Scania trucks. He couldn't understand why anyone would have anything else. Then, after years of consumer loyalty, they merged with Saab. It was a treachery he never quite forgave them for. Uwe, who in turn had become very interested in Scania when they merged with Saab, looked thoughtfully out of the window whilst chewing his potato.
"Does it run well?" he asked.
"Nope," muttered the old man irascibly, and went back to his plate.
"None of their models run well. None of them are built right. Mechanics want half a fortune to fix anything on it,"
he added, as if he was actually explaining it to someone sitting under the table.
"I can have a look at it, if you'll let me," said Uwe, and looked enthusiastic all of a sudden. It was the first time Sonia could ever remember him actually sounding enthusiastic about anything. The two men looked at each other for a moment. Then Sonia's father nodded, and Uwe nodded curtly back. And then they rose to their feet, objective and determined, in the way two men might behave if they had just agreed to go and kill a third man. A few minutes later, Sonia's father came back into the kitchen, leaning on his stick, and sank into his chair with his chronically dissatisfied mumbling. He sat there for a good while, stuffing his pipe with care, then at last nodded at the saucepans and managed to say,
"Nice."
"Thanks, Dad," she smiled.
"You cooked it, not me," he said.
The thanks was not for the food, she answered, and took away the plates, kissing her father tenderly on his forehead at the same time as she saw Uwe diving in under the bonnet of the truck in the yard. Her father said nothing, just stood up with a quiet snort and took the newspaper from the kitchen top. Halfway to his armchair in the living room, he stopped himself, however, and stood there slightly unresolved, leaning on his stick.
"Does he fish?"
he finally grunted without looking at her.
"I don't think so," Sonia answered.
Her father nodded gruffly, stood silent for a long while.
"I see. He'll have to learn then," he grumbled at long last,
before putting his pipe in his mouth and disappearing into the living room. Sonia had never heard him give anyone a higher compliment. Chapter 17. A Man Called Uwe and a Cat Annoyance in a Snowdrift.
"Is it dead?" Pavana asks in terror, as she rushes forward as quickly as her pregnant belly will allow, and stands there staring down into the hole.
"I'm not a vet," Uwe replies, not in an unfriendly way, just as a point of information.
He doesn't understand where this woman keeps appearing from all the time. Can't a man calmly and quietly stand over a cat-shaped hole in a snowdrift in his own garden anymore?
"You have to get him out," she cries, hitting him on the shoulder with her glove.
Uwe looks displeased and pushes his hands deeper into his jacket pockets. He is still having a bit of trouble breathing.
"Don't have to at all," he says.
"Jesus, what's wrong with you?"
"I don't get along with cats very well," Uwe informs her and plants his heels in the snow.
But her gaze when she turns round makes him move a little further away.
"Maybe he's sleeping,"
he offers, peering into the hole, before adding,
"Otherwise he'll come out when it thaws."
When the glove comes flying past him again, he confirms to himself that keeping a safe distance was a very sound idea. But the next thing he knows, Pavana has dived into the snowdrift. She emerges seconds later with the little deep-frozen creature in her thin arms. It looks like four ice lollies, clumsily wrapped in a shredded scarf.
"Open the door!"
she yells, really losing her composure now. Uwe presses the soles of his shoes into the snow. He has certainly not begun this day with the intention of letting either women or cats into his house. He'd like to make that very clear to her. But she comes right at him with the animal in her arms and a determination in her steps.
It's really only a question of the speed of his reactions, whether she walks through him or past him. Uwe has never experienced a worse woman when it comes to listening to what decent people tell her. He feels out of breath again. He fights the impulse to clutch his breast. She keeps going. He gives way. She strides past. The small, icicle-decorated package in her arms obstinately brings up a flow of memories in Uwe's head before he can put a stop to them. Memories of Ernest, fat, stupid old Ernest, so beloved of Sonia that you could have bounced 5 crown coins on her heart whenever she saw him. "Open the door, then!" Pavana roars and looks round at Uwe so abruptly that there's a danger of whiplash. Uwe hauls out the keys from his pocket, as if someone else has taken control of his arms. He's having a hard time accepting what he's actually doing. One part of him, in his head, is yelling, "No!" while the rest of his body is busy with some sort of teenage rebellion. "Get me some blankets," Pavana orders, and runs across the threshold with her shoes still on. Uwe stands there for a few moments, catching his breath, before he ambles off after her. "It's bloody freezing in here. Turn up the radiators," Pavana tosses out the words as if this is something quite obvious, gesturing impatiently at Uwe as she puts the cat down on his sofa. "There'll be no turning up of radiators here," Uwe announces firmly. He parks himself in the living room doorway and wonders whether she might try to swat him again with the glove if he tells her at least to put some newspapers under the cat. When she turns to him again, he decides to give it a miss. Uwe doesn't know if he's ever seen such an angry woman. "I've got a blanket upstairs," he says at long last, avoiding her gaze by suddenly feeling incredibly interested in the hall lamp. "Get it then!" Uwe looks as if he's repeating her words to himself, though silently in an affected, disdainful voice. But he takes off his shoes and crosses the living room at a cautious distance from her glove-striking range. All the way up and down the stairs, he mumbles to himself about why it has to be so damn difficult to get any peace and quiet in this street. Upstairs, he stops and takes a few deep breaths. The pain in his chest has gone. His heart is beating normally again. It happens now and then, and he no longer gets stressed about it. It always passes, and he won't be needing that heart for very much longer, so it doesn't matter either way. He hears voices from the living room. He can hardly believe his ears. Considering how they are constantly preventing him from dying, these neighbours of his are certainly not shy when it comes to driving a man to the brink of madness and suicide, that's for sure. When Uwe comes back down the stairs with the blanket in his hand, the overweight young man from next door is standing in the middle of his living room, looking with curiosity at the cat and Pavana. "Hey, man," he says cheerfully, and waves at Uwe. He's only wearing a T-shirt, even though there's snow outside. "Okay," says Uwe, silently appalled, that you can pop upstairs for a moment only to find when you come back down that you've apparently started a bed and breakfast operation. "I heard someone shouting. Just wanted to check that everything was cool here," says the young man jovially, shrugging his shoulders so that his back blubber folds the T-shirt into deep wrinkles. Pavana snatches the blanket out of Uwe's hand and starts wrapping the cat in it. "You'll never get him warm like that," says the young man pleasantly. "Don't interfere," says Uwe, who, while perhaps not an expert at defrosting cats, does not appreciate at all having people marching into his house and issuing orders about how things should be done. "Be quiet, Uwe," says Pavana, and looks entreatingly at the young man. "What shall we do then? He's ice cold." "Don't tell me to be quiet," mumbles Uwe. "He'll die," says Pavana. "Die my ass, he's just a bit chilly," Uwe interjects in a new attempt to regain control over the situation. The pregnant one puts her index finger over his lips and hushes him. Uwe looks so absurdly irritated at this, it's as if he's going to break into some sort of rage-fueled pirouette. When Pavana holds up the cat, it has started shifting in colour from purple to white. Uwe looks a little less sure of himself when he notices this. He glances at Pavana, then reluctantly steps back and gives way. The young, overweight man takes off his T-shirt.
But what the... This has got to be the... What are you doing? Stutters Uwe.
His eyes flicker from Pavana by the sofa with the defrosting cat in her arms and water dripping onto the floor to the young man standing there with his torso bare in the middle of Uwe's living room, the fat trembling over his chest down towards his knees as if he were a big pack of ice cream that had first melted and then been refrozen.
Here, give him to me,
says the young man unconcernedly and reaches over with two arms, thick as tree trunks, towards Pavana. When she hands over the cat, he encloses it in his enormous embrace, pressing it against his chest as if trying to make a gigantic cat spring roll.
By the way, my name's Jimmy,
he says to Pavana and smiles. I'm Pavana, says Pavana.
Nice name, says Jimmy. Thanks, it means butterfly, Pavana smiles.
Nice, says Jimmy. You'll smother that cat, says Uwe.
Oh, give it a rest, will you, Uwe? Says Jimmy.
I reckon it would rather freeze to death in a dignified manner than be strangled, he says to Jimmy, nodding at the dripping ball of fluff pressed into his arms. Jimmy pulls his good-tempered face into a big grin.
Chill a bit, Uwe. You can say what you like about us fatties, but we're the dog's bollocks when it comes to pumping out a bit of heat.
Pavana peers nervously over his blubbery upper arm and gently puts the palm of her hand against the cat's nose. Then she brightens.
He's getting warmer, she exclaims, turning to Uwe in triumph.
Uwe nods. He was about to say something sarcastic to her. Now he finds, uneasily, that he's relieved at the news. He distracts himself from this emotion by assiduously inspecting the TV remote control. Not that he's concerned about the cat. It's just that Sonia would have been happy. Nothing more than that. I'll heat a bit of water, says Pavana. And in a single snappy movement, she slips past Uwe and is suddenly standing in his kitchen, tugging at his kitchen cabinets.
What the hell?
Mumbles Uwe as he lets go of the remote control and tears off in pursuit. When he gets there, she's standing motionless and slightly confused in the middle of the floor with his electric kettle in her hand. She looks a bit overwhelmed, as if the realization of what's happened has only just hit her. It's the first time Uwe has seen this woman run out of something to say. The kitchen has been cleared and tidied, but it's dusty. It smells of stewed coffee. There's dirt in the crannies, and everywhere are Uwe's wife's things. Her little decorative objects in the window, her hair grips left on the kitchen table, her handwriting on the post-it notes on the fridge. The kitchen is filled with those soft wheel marks, as if someone has been going back and forth with a bicycle thousands of times. The cooker and kitchen counter are noticeably lower than is usual, as if the kitchen had been built for a child. Pavana stares at them the way people always do when they see it for the first time. Uwe has got used to it. He rebuilt the kitchen himself after the accident. The council refused to help, of course. Pavana looks as if she's somehow got stuck. Uwe takes the electric kettle out of her outstretched hands without looking into her eyes. Slowly he fills it with water and plugs it in.
I didn't know, Uwe, she whispers, contrite.
Uwe leans over the low sink with his back to her. She comes forward and puts her fingertips gently on his shoulder.
I'm sorry, Uwe, really. I shouldn't have barged into your kitchen without asking first.
Uwe clears his throat and nods without turning round. He doesn't know how long they stand there. She lets her enervated hand rest on his shoulder. He decides not to push it away. Jimmy's voice breaks the silence.
You got anything to eat?
He calls out from the living room. Uwe's shoulder slips away from Pavana's hand. He shakes his head, wipes his face with the back of his hand, and heads off to the fridge, still without looking at her. Jimmy clucks gratefully when Uwe comes out of the kitchen and hands him a sausage sandwich. Uwe parks himself a few meters away and looks a bit grim.
So, how is he then?
He says with a curt nod at the cat in Jimmy's arms. Water is dripping liberally onto the floor now, but the animal is slowly but surely regaining both its shape and color.
Seems better, no?
Grins Jimmy as he wolfs down the sandwich in a single bite. Uwe gives him a sceptical look. Jimmy is perspiring like a bit of pork left on a sauna boiler. There's something mournful in his eyes when he looks back at Uwe.
You know, it was pretty bad with your wife, Uwe. I always liked her. She made, like, the best chow in town.
Uwe looks at him, and for the first time all morning, he doesn't look a bit angry.
Yes, she cooked very well, he agrees.
He goes over to the window, and with his back to the room, tugs at the handle as if to check it, pokes the rubber seal. Pavana stands in the kitchen doorway, wrapping her arms around herself and her belly.
He can stay here until he's completely defrosted, then you have to take him, says Uwe, shrugging towards the cat.
He can see in the corner of his eye how she's peering at him, as if she's trying to figure out what sort of hand he has from the other side of a casino table. It makes him uneasy.
I'm afraid I can't, she says after that. The girls are allergic, she adds.
Uwe hears a little pause before she says, allergic. He scrutinizes her suspiciously in the reflection in the window, but does not answer. Instead, he turns to the overweight young man.
So you'll have to take care of it, he says.
Jimmy, who's not only sweating buckets now but also turning blotchy and red in his face, looks down benevolently at the cat. It's slowly started moving its stump of a tail and burrowing its dripping nose deeper into Jimmy's generous folds of upper arm fat.
Don't think it's such a cool idea, me taking care of the puss. Sorry, man, says Jimmy, and shrugs tremulously, so that the cat makes a circus tumble and ends up upside down.
He holds out his arms. His skin is red as if he's on fire.
I'm a bit allergic as well.
Pavana gives off a little scream, runs up to him, takes the cat away from him, quickly enfolding it in the blanket again.
We have to get to a hospital, she yells.
I'm barred from the hospital, Uwe replies without thinking about it.
When he peers in her direction and she looks ready to throw the cat at him, he looks down again and groans disconsolately.
All I want is to die, he thinks to himself and presses his toes into one of the floorboards. It flexes slightly.
Uwe looks up at Jimmy, looks at the cat, surveys the wet floor, shakes his head at Pavana.
We'll have to take my car then, he mutters.
He takes his jacket from the hook and opens the front door. After a few seconds, he sticks his head back into the hall, glares at Pavana.
But I'm not bringing the car to the house because it's prohibit...
She interrupts him with some words in Farsi that Uwe can't understand. Nonetheless, he finds them unnecessarily dramatic. She wraps the cat more tightly in the blanket and walks past him into the snow.
Rules are rules, you know,
says Uwe truculently as she heads off to the parking area, but she doesn't answer. Uwe turns round and points at Jimmy.
And you, put on a jumper, or you're not going anywhere in the Saab. Let's be clear about that.
Pavana pays for the parking at the hospital. Uwe doesn't make a fuss about it. Chapter 18. A man who was Uwe and a cat called Ernest. Uwe didn't dislike this cat in particular. It's just that he didn't much like cats in general. He'd always perceived them as untrustworthy, especially when, as in the case of Ernest, they were as big as mopeds. It was actually quite difficult to determine whether he was just an unusually large cat or an outstandingly small lion. And you should never befriend something if there's a possibility it may take a fancy to eating you in your sleep. But Sonia loved Ernest so unconditionally that Uwe managed to keep this kind of perfectly sensible observation to himself. He knew better than to speak ill of what she loved. After all, he understood very keenly how it was to receive her love when no one else could understand why he was worthy of it. So he and Ernest learned to get along reasonably well when they visited the cottage in the forest, apart from the fact that Ernest bit Uwe once when he sat on his tail on one of the kitchen chairs. Or at least they learned to keep their distance, just like Uwe and Sonia's father. Even if Uwe's view was that this cat annoyance was not entitled to sit on one chair and spread his tail over another, he let it go, for Sonia's sake. Uwe learned to fish. In the two autumns that followed their first visit, The roof of the house for the first time ever did not leak, and the truck started every time the key was turned without as much as a splutter. Of course, Sonia's father was not openly grateful about this, but on the other hand, he never again brought up his reservations about Uwe being from town. And this, from Sonia's father, was as good a proof of affection as any. 2 springs passed, and 2 summers, and in the third year, one cool June night, Sonia's father died. And Uwe had never seen anyone cry like Sonia cried then. The first few days she hardly got out of bed. Uwe, for someone who had run into death as much as he had in his life, had a very paltry relationship to his feelings about it, and he pushed it all away in some confusion in the kitchen of the forest cottage. The pastor from the village church came by and ran through the details of the burial. "A good man," stated the pastor succinctly, and pointed at one of the photos of Sonia and her father on the living room wall. Uwe nodded, didn't know what he was expected to say to that one. Then he went outside to see if anything on the truck needed fiddling with. On the 4th day, Sonia got out of bed and started cleaning the cottage with such frenetic energy that Uwe kept out of her way, in the way that insightful folk avoid an oncoming tornado. He meandered about the farm, looking for things to do. He rebuilt the woodshed, which had collapsed in one of the winter storms. In the coming days, he filled it with newly cut wood, mowed the grass, lopped overhanging branches from the surrounding forest. Late on the evening of the 6th day, they called from the grocery store. Everyone called it an accident, of course, but no one who had met Ernest could believe that he had run out in front of a car by accident. Sorrow does strange things to living creatures. Uwe drove faster than he had ever driven on the roads that night. Sonia held Ernest's big head in her hands all the way. He was still breathing when they made it to the vet, but his injuries were far too serious, the loss of blood too great. After 2 hours crouching at his side in the operating theatre, Sonia kissed the cat's wide brow and whispered, "Goodbye, darling Ernest." And then, as if the words were coming out of her mouth wrapped in wisps of cloud, "And goodbye to you, my darling father." And then the cat closed his eyes and died. When Sonia came out of the waiting room, she rested her forehead heavily against Uwe's broad chest. "I feel so much loss, Uwe. Loss, as if my heart was beating outside my body." They stood in silence for a long time, with their arms around each other. And at long last, she lifted her face towards his and looked into his eyes with great seriousness. "You have to love me twice as much now," she said. And then Uwe lied to her for the second and last time. He said that he would, even though he knew it wasn't possible for him to love her any more than he already did. They buried Ernest beside the lake where he used to go fishing with Sonia's father. The pastor was there to read the blessing. After that, Uwe loaded up the Saab and they drove back on the small roads, with Sonia's head leaning against his shoulder. On the way, he stopped in the first little town they passed through. Sonia had arranged to meet someone there. Uwe did not know who. It was one of the traits she appreciated most about him, she often said long after the event. She knew no one else who could sit in a car for an hour waiting without demanding to know what he was waiting for or how long it would take. Which was not to say that Uwe did not moan, because moaning was one thing he excelled at, especially if he had to pay for the parking. But he never asked what she was doing, and he always waited for her. Then when Sonia came out at last and got back inside, closing the Saab's door with a soft squeeze, which she knew was required to avoid a wounded glance from him as if she'd kicked a living creature, she gently took his hand. "I think we need to buy a house of our own," she said softly. "What's the point of that?" Uwe wondered. "I think our child has to grow up in a house," she said, and carefully moved his hand down to her belly. Uwe was quiet for a long time even by Uwe's standards. He looked thoughtfully at her stomach, as if expecting it to raise some sort of flag. Then he straightened up, twisted the tuning button half a turn forward and half a turn back, adjusted his wing mirrors, and nodded sensibly. We'll have to get a Saab estate then. Chapter 19. A man called Uwe and a cat that was broken when he came. Uwe spent most of yesterday shouting at Pavana that this damned cat would live in Uwe's house over his dead body. And now here he stands, looking at the cat, and the cat looks back. And Uwe remains strikingly non-dead. It's all incredibly irritating. A half dozen times Uwe has woken up in the night when the cat, with more than a little disrespect, has crawled up and stretched out next to him in the bed. And just as many times the cat has woken up when Uwe, with more than a bit of brusqueness, has booted it down to the floor again. Now, when it's gone 5:45 and Uwe has got up, the cat is sitting in the middle of the kitchen floor. It sports a disgruntled expression, as if Uwe owes it money. Uwe stares back at it with a suspicion normally reserved for a cat that has rung his doorbell with a Bible in its paws, like a Jehovah's Witness. "I suppose you're expecting food," mutters Uwe at last. The cat doesn't answer. It just nibbles its remaining patches of fur and nonchalantly licks one of its paw pads. "But in this house you don't just lounge about like some kind of consultant and expect fried sparrows to fly into your mouth." Uwe goes to the sink, turns on the coffee maker, checks his watch, looks at the cat. After leaving the hospital, Pavana had managed to get hold of a friend who was apparently a veterinarian. The veterinarian had come to have a look at the cat and concluded that there was serious frostbite and advanced malnutrition. And then he'd given Uwe a long list of instructions about what the cat needed to eat and its general care. "I'm not running a cat repair company," Uwe clarifies to the cat. "You're only here because I couldn't talk any sense into that pregnant woman." He nods across the living room towards the window facing onto Pavana's house. The cat, busying itself trying to lick one of its eyes, does not reply. Uwe holds up 4 little socks towards it. He was given them by the veterinarian. Apparently the cat annoyance needs exercise more than anything, and this is something Uwe feels he may be able to help it achieve. The further from his wallpaper those claws are, the better. That's Uwe's reasoning. "Hop into these things and then we can go. I'm running late." The cat gets up elaborately and walks with long, self-conscious steps towards the door, as if walking on a red carpet. It gives the socks an initial skeptical look, but doesn't cause too much of a fuss when Uwe quite roughly puts them on. When he's done, Uwe stands up and scrutinizes the cat from top to bottom, shakes his head. A cat wearing socks, it can't be natural. The cat, now standing there checking out its new outfit, suddenly looks immeasurably pleased with itself. Uwe makes an extra loop to the end of the pathway. Outside Anita and Runa's house, he picks up a cigarette butt. He rolls it between his fingers. That Skoda driving man from the council seems to drive about in these parts as if he owned them. Uwe swears and puts the butt in his pocket. When they get back to the house, Uwe reluctantly feeds the wretched animal and, once it's finished, announces that they've got errands to run. He may have been temporarily press-ganged into cohabiting with this little creature, but he'll be damned if he's going to leave a wild animal on its own in his house. So the cat has to come with him. Immediately there's a disagreement between Uwe and the cat about whether or not the cat should sit on a sheet of newspaper in the Saab's passenger seat. At first, Uwe sits the cat on 2 supplements of entertainment news, which the cat, much insulted, kicks onto the floor with its back feet. It makes itself comfortable on the soft upholstery. At this, Uwe firmly picks up the cat by the scruff of its neck, so that the cat hisses at him in a not-so-passive-aggressive manner, while Uwe shoves 3 cultural supplements and book reviews under him. The cat gives him a furious look. Uwe puts him down, but oddly enough it stays on the newspaper and only looks out of the window with a wounded, dismal expression. Uwe concludes that he's won the battle, nods with satisfaction, puts the Saab into gear and drives onto the main road. Only then does the cat slowly and deliberately drag its claws in a long tear across the newsprint and then puts both its front paws through the rip, while at the same time giving Uwe a highly challenging look, as if to ask, "And what are you going to do about it?" Uwe slams on the brakes of the Saab so that the cat, shocked, is thrown forward and bangs its nose against the dashboard.
That's what I have to say about it,
Uwe's triumphant expression seems to say. After that, the cat refuses to look at Uwe for the rest of the journey and just sits hunched up in a corner of the seat, rubbing its nose with one of its paws in a very offended way. But while Uwe is inside the florist's, it licks long wet streaks across Uwe's steering wheel, safety belt, and the inside of Uwe's car door. When Uwe comes back with the flowers and discovers that his whole car is full of cat saliva, he waves his forefinger in a threatening manner, as if it were a scimitar. And then the cat bites his scimitar. Uwe refuses to speak to him for the rest of the journey. When they get to the churchyard, Uwe plays it safe and scrunches up the remains of the newspaper into a ball, with which he roughly pushes the cat out of the car. Then he gets the flowers out of the boot, locks the Saab with his key, makes a circuit around it and checks each of the doors. Together they climb the frozen, gravelled slope leading up to the church turnoff and force their way through the snow before they stop by Sonia. Uwe brushes some snow off the gravestone with the back of his hand and gives the flowers a little shake.
"I've brought some flowers with me," he mumbles.
"Pink, which you like.
They say they die in the frost, but they only tell you that to trick you into buying the more expensive ones."
The cat sinks down on its behind in the snow. Uwe gives it a sullen look, then refocuses on the gravestone.
"Right, right, this is the cat annoyance. It's living with us now. Almost froze to death outside our house."
The cat gives Uwe an offended look. Uwe clears his throat.
"It looked like that when he came," he clarifies, a sudden defensive note in his voice. Then with a nod at the cat and the gravestone, "So it wasn't me who broke him. He was already broken," he adds to Sonia.
Both the gravestone and the cat wait in silence beside him. Uwe stares at his shoes for a moment, grunts, sinks onto his knees in the snow, and brushes a bit more snow off the stone. Carefully lays his hand on it.
"I miss you," he whispers.
There's a quick gleam in the corner of Uwe's eye. He feels something soft against his arm. It takes a few seconds before he realizes that the cat is gently resting his head in the palm of his hand. Chapter 20. A Man Called Uwe and an Intruder. For almost 20 minutes, Uwe sits in the driver's seat of the Saab with the garage door open. For the first 5 minutes, the cat stares at him impatiently from the passenger seat. During the next 5, it begins to look properly worried. In the end, it tries to open the door itself. When this fails, it promptly lies down on the seat and goes to sleep. Uwe glances at it as it rolls onto its side and starts snoring. He has to concede that the cat annoyance has a very direct approach to problem solving. He looks out over the parking area again at the garage opposite. He must have stood out there with Runa 100 times. They were friends once. Uwe can't think of very many people in his life he could describe as such. Uwe and Uwe's wife were the first people to move into this street of terraced houses all those years ago, when it had only recently been built and was still surrounded by trees. That same day, Runa and Runa's wife moved in. Anita was also pregnant and, of course, immediately became best friends with Uwe's wife in that way only women knew how. And just as all women who become best friends, they both had the idea that Runa and Uwe had to become best friends because they had so many interests in common. Uwe couldn't really understand what they meant by that. After all, Runa drove a Volvo. Not that Uwe exactly had anything against Runa, apart from that. He had a proper job, and he didn't talk more than he had to. Admittedly, he did drive that Volvo, but as Uwe's wife kept insisting, this did not necessarily make a person immoral. So Uwe put up with him. After a period, he even lent him tools. And one afternoon, standing in the parking area, thumbs tucked into their belts, they got caught up in a conversation about lawnmower prices. When they parted, they shook hands, as if the mutual decision to become friends was a business agreement. When the two men later found out that all sorts of people were moving into the area, they sat down in Uwe and Sonia's kitchen for consultations. By the time they emerged from these, they had established a shared framework of rules, signs clarifying what was permitted or not, and a newly set up steering group for the Residents Association. Uwe was the chairman, Runa the vice chairman. In the months that followed, they went to the dump together, grumbled at people who had parked their cars incorrectly, bargained for better deals on paint and drain pipes at the ironmongers, stood on either side of the man from the telephone company when he came to install telephones and jack plugs, brusquely pointing out where and how he should best go about it. Not that either of them knew exactly how telephone cables should be installed, but they were both well-versed in keeping an eye on whippersnappers like this one to stop them pulling a fast one. That was all there was to it. Sometimes the two couples had dinner together, insofar as one could have dinner when Uwe and Runa mostly just stood about in the parking area the whole evening, kicking the tires of their cars and comparing their load capacity, turning radius and other significant matters. And that was all there was to it. Sonia and Anita's bellies kept growing steadily, which, according to Runa, made Anita do lally in the brain. Apparently, he had to look for the coffee pot in the fridge more or less daily once she was in her third month. Sonia, not to be outdone, developed a temper that could flare up quicker than a pair of saloon doors in a John Wayne film, which made Uwe reluctant to open his mouth at all. This, of course, gave further cause for irritation. When she wasn't breaking out in a sweat, she was freezing. And as soon as Uwe tired of arguing with her and agreed to turn up the radiators by a half step, she started sweating again, and he had to run round and turn them back down again. She also ate bananas in such quantities that the people at the supermarket must have thought Uwe had started a zoo. "The hormones are on the warpath," Runa said with an insightful nod during one of the nights when he and Uwe sat in the outside space behind his house, while the two women kept to Sonia and Uwe's kitchen, talking about whatever it is women talk about. Runa told him that he had found Anita crying her eyes out by the radio the day before for no other reason than that it was a nice song. "A nice song?" said Uwe, perplexed. "A nice song," Runa answered. The two men shook their heads in mutual disbelief and stared out into the darkness. Sat in silence. "The grass needs cutting," said Runa at last. "I bought new blades for the mower," Uwe nodded. "How much did you pay for them?" And so their friendship went on. In the evening, Sonia played music for her belly because she said it made the child move. Uwe mostly just sat in his armchair on the other side of the room and pretended to be watching television while she was doing it. In his innermost thoughts, he was worried about what it would be like once the child finally decided to come out. What if, for example, the kid disliked Uwe because Uwe wasn't so fond of music? It's not that Uwe was afraid. He just didn't know how to prepare himself for fatherhood. He had asked for some sort of manual, but Sonia had just laughed at him. Uwe didn't understand why. There were manuals for everything else. He was doubtful about whether he'd be any good at being someone's dad. He didn't like children an awful lot. He hadn't even been very good at being a child. Sonia thought he should talk to Runa about it because they were in the same situation. Uwe couldn't quite understand what she meant by that. Runa was not, in fact, going to be the father of Uwe's child, but an altogether different one. At least Runa agreed with Uwe about the point of not having much to discuss, and that was something. So when Anita came over in the evenings and sat in the kitchen with Sonia talking about the aches and pains and all those things, Uwe and Runa made the excuse of having things to talk about, and went out to Uwe's shed and just stood there in silence, picking at various bits on Uwe's workbench. Standing there next to each other with a closed door for a third night on the trot, without knowing what they were supposed to do with themselves, they agreed that they needed to get busy with something before, as Runa put it, the new neighbours start thinking there's some sort of monkey business going on in here. Uwe agreed that it might be best to do as he said, and so it was. They didn't talk much while they were doing it, but they helped each other with the drawings and measuring the angles and ensuring that the corners were straight and properly done. And late one evening when Anita and Sonia were in the fourth month, two light blue cots were installed in the prepared nurseries of their terraced houses.
We can rub it down and repaint it pink, if we get a girl, mumbled Uwe when he showed it to Sonia. Sonia put her arms around him, and he felt his neck getting all wet with her tears. Completely irrational hormones.
I want you to ask me to be your wife, she whispered.
And so it was. They married in the town hall, very simply. Neither of them had any family, so only Runa and Anita came. Sonia and Uwe put on their rings, and then all four of them went to a restaurant. Uwe paid, but Runa helped check the bill to make sure it had been done properly. Of course it hadn't, so after conferring with the waiter for about an hour, the two men managed to convince him it would be easier for him if he halved the bill or they'd report him. Obviously, it was a bit hazy exactly who would report who for what, but eventually, with a certain amount of swearing and arm-waving, the waiter gave up and went into the kitchen and wrote them a new bill. In the meantime, Runa and Uwe nodded grimly at one another without noticing that their wives, as usual, had taken a taxi home 20 minutes earlier. Uwe nods to himself as he sits there in the Saab, looking at Runa's garage door. He can't remember when he last saw it open. He turns off the headlights of the Saab, gives the cat a poke to wake it up, and gets out. Uwe, says a curious, unfamiliar voice. Suddenly an unknown woman, clearly the owner of the unfamiliar voice, has stuck her head into the garage. She's about 45, wearing tatty jeans and a green windcheater jacket that looks too large for her. She doesn't have any makeup on and her hair is in a ponytail. The woman blunders into his garage and looks around with interest. The cat steps forward and gives her a threatening hiss. She stops. Uwe puts his hands in his pockets. Uwe, she bursts out again in that exaggerated, chummy way of people who want to sell you something whilst pretending it's the very last thing on their mind. I don't want anything, says Uwe, nodding at the garage door, a clear gesture that she needn't bother about finding another door. It'll be just fine if she walks out the same way that she came. She looks utterly unchastened by that. My name is Lena. I'm a journalist at the local newspaper and, well, she begins and then offers her hand. Uwe looks at her hand and looks at her. I don't want anything, he says again. What? I suppose you're selling subscriptions, but I don't want one. She looks puzzled. Right, well, actually, I'm not selling the paper. I write for it. I'm a journalist, she repeats slowly, as if there was something wrong with him. I still don't want anything, Uwe reiterates as he starts shooing her out of the garage door. But I want to talk to you, Uwe, she protests and starts trying to force herself back inside. Uwe waves his hands at her, as if trying to scare her away by shaking an invisible rug in front of her. You saved a man's life at the train station yesterday. I want to interview you about it, she calls out excitedly. Clearly she's about to say something else when she notices that she's lost Uwe's attention. His gaze falls on something behind her. His eyes turn to slits. I'll be damned, he mumbles. Yes, I'd like to ask you... She begins sincerely, but Uwe has already squeezed past her and started running towards the white Skoda that's turned up by the parking area and started driving down towards the houses. The bespectacled woman is caught off guard when Uwe charges forward and bangs on the window, and she throws the file of documents into her own face. The man in the white shirt, on the other hand, is quite unmoved. He rolls down the window. Yes? He asks. Vehicle traffic is prohibited in the residential area. Uwe hisses and points at each of the houses, at the Skoda, at the man in the white shirt, and at the parking area. In this residence association, we park in the parking area. The man in the white shirt looks at the houses, then at the parking area, then at Uwe. I have permission from the council to drive up to the houses, so I have to ask you to get out of the way. Uwe is so agitated by his answer that it takes him many seconds even just to formulate some swear words by way of an answer. Meanwhile, the man in the shirt has picked up a pack of cigarettes from the dashboard, which he taps against his trouser leg. Would you be kind enough to get out of the way? He asks Uwe.
What are you doing here?
Uwe blurts out. That's nothing for you to worry yourself about, says the man in the white shirt with a monotone voice, as if he's a computer-generated voicemail message, letting Uwe know that he's been placed in a telephone queue. He puts the cigarette he's shaken out in his mouth and lights it. Uwe breathes so heavily that his chest is pumping up and down under his jacket. The woman gathers up her papers and files and adjusts her glasses. The man just sighs, as if Uwe is a cheeky child refusing to stop riding his skateboard on the pavement. You know what I'm doing here. We're taking Runa in the house at the bottom into care. He hangs his arm out of the window and flicks the ash against the wing mirror of the Skoda. Taking him into care? Yeah, says the man, nodding indifferently. And if Anita doesn't want that? Uwe hisses, tapping his index finger against the roof of the car. The man in the white shirt looks at the woman in the passenger seat and smiles resignedly. Then he turns to Uwe again and speaks very slowly, as if otherwise Uwe might not understand his words. It's not up to Anita to make that decision. It's up to the investigation team. Uwe's breathing becomes even more strained. He can feel his pulse in his throat. You're not bringing this car into this area, he says through gritted teeth. His fists are clenched. His tone is pointed and threatening, but his opponent looks quite